Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Yo, bro, you think you know ball? You gotta try Sleeper Picks. Just pick more or less from your boy's stats, and you can cop a stack for real. If you think he's going off, pick more. If he's about to lay some bricks, take less. Is it Dame time? Use Sleeper's alternate pick for him to score 30+. Is someone in Philly going to choke because it's the playoffs? Take less than all their stats. And Sleeper's even got your back with FlexPay, so you can still cop a smaller stack if one of your picks misses. But that ain't even it, Chief. If you're new to the game, Sleeper's going to double your first deposit up to $500 when you use my promo code CONTEST. No cap, you just got to download Sleeper now. Madheads are loving this app, and it's time for you to get the bag too. Just use code CONTEST to make sure Sleeper hooks you up with a $500 deposit match. That's promo code CONTEST. Must be 18 years old. Promo code, location, and other restrictions apply. Deposit match bonus issued as non-withdrawable playthrough funds. See terms of use for details. Please play responsibly. Call 1-800-426-2537 for help.
Did you listen to the 30 for 30 that just came out this summer about Sterling?
Yes, and I listened to all five episodes with Ramona Shelburne and then listened to the recap, and it was outstanding.
What did you, I mean, I don't know how familiar you were with the whole situation. What did you learn?
Well, I mean, I think what the podcast revealed was a little bit of layer of personality. I mean, obviously I was very familiar with the Sterling situation by being in the NBA
right.
for 3 weeks at the time. But
oh, you had just gotten the job.
I literally had just started. In fact, my contract start date was July 15th, and but I kind of started in April. And I, like the rest of the world, was kind of stunned. And then listening to all the different interviews and Shelley Sterling and all the different pieces, it reminded me what an incredible job Adam Silver had done.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that alone could sort of define him. However, and by the way, I have no idea what you're allowed to say or not allowed to say, like on or off the record. So if anything's off the record, you just tell me.
Right.
Or say, Matt, I can't answer that. And honestly, I didn't intend to necessarily go this deep this quick on NBA stuff. But some folks feel like he sat on his hands about a lot of other stuff.
I don't know how to answer that. I'm not even sure I understand what you're saying.
Like, that was this amazing statement that none of us were ready for, right? Like, we thought, what's going to happen? And then he did more than we thought, which is usually, like, when it comes to punishing players or owners, there's a lot of hand slapping. People get very upset. In this case, he went, like, yay, we got rid of this bad apple. But then there's other situations since, with Adam that maybe he's not as quick to act.
I think Adam's done a great job, and I can't think of anything on the scale of comparable to Donald Sterling. So.
Okay. All right. We'll back up. Where did you grow up?
I grew up about 7 miles down the road from here.
In what town is that? Which way are you pointing?
Atlanta.
So we're in his offices, right?
Right.
We are right, let's see, to our, is this west?
I'm Jewish. We wandered for 40 years. I have no idea.
I am also Jewish.
Okay, and you also have no sense of direction.
I also have no sense of direction. So to my left, then, we'll say a Centennial Park.
I did not grow up in Centennial Park. On the North Druid Hills, Emory side of town.
Got it.
My family's been in Atlanta for well over 90 years.
Okay.
And I'm one of the few native Atlantans. We don't breed well in captivity.
Where did you go to Hebrew school?
I went to, I didn't go to Hebrew school per se. I went to after school at Beth Jacob, which my family was an early, early member. So till my bar mitzvah, and then that was kind of it.
Right. I grew up in Marietta and went to Congregation Etz Chaim,
which we belonged to for 20 plus years.
Really?
I probably sat down the aisle from you. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Well, let's see. My bar mitzvah was in 19... How old am I? In 1985?
I'm a bit older than you. I got married in 1985.
There weren't... I was, I think, as sort of metropolitan as Marietta is, I think I was the first Jewish person a lot of my friends had ever met.
Interesting.
I mean, maybe by now it's come up sort of more, but I distinctly remember like them being puzzled.
As I am to this part of the conversation.
So you've never left here.
Never left.
And what did young Steve want to do?
Young Steve wanted to sell liquor.
Really?
And back when I was in college in Athens, the drinking age was 18. So I spent all my summers working in liquor stores. And when the business was a little slow, I would open up the periodicals, Wine Spectator and industry magazines, and read all about it. And I really liked the business, and I liked the sales guys who were coming in. And so my first job out of school was with National Distributors. And I had an area of town that I would sell whiskey, wine, spirits, and did it for about 3 years. It was a lot of fun.
And what point did you say, okay, maybe this isn't for me?
Well, kind of the opposite happened. If you do a pretty good job, then a distillery picks you up.
Right.
And so I got hired by a company called Hiram Walker out of Canada. And I sold Kahlua, Courvoisier, Canadian Club to distributors. So I went from selling to retailers to selling to distributors. And then in 1986, after I had recently been married, I was offered to, the company was restructuring. They wanted to move me up to headquarters in Walkerville, Ontario, Canada, which I did not think was a career path that I wanted to take. So I literally left the company, made a cold call at 5 o'clock at night, 676-2121 to the Coca-Cola company, asked for head of marketing. Guy named John Farrell answered his phone. Pitched him that I had been in the spirits business and I saw an opportunity for Coca-Cola and to play a real pro-social role in Mothers Against Drunk Driving and to offer a beverage alternative in the bar and tavern segment. And he said, that's really interesting. Come in and see me. And they hired me. So one phone call, one answer of the phone changed the trajectory of my entire life.
So this is 1986. So we have to sort of give... you know, remind folks what the landscape of the world is like. There's no LinkedIn.
No.
There's no internet, period.
No.
There's just, let me look up, what, in the phone book, the number? Or call 411?
Probably called information. Probably a little
too much. It said, what's the number at Coca-Cola?
Yeah.
And they told you, and you just knew that marketing was the right department?
Yeah, head of marketing, please.
That's amazing.
It's a true story.
That's amazing.
Every bit true.
And so he liked your, and was like, yeah, man, come in and let's talk.
Yeah. And I went there and had several meetings, and they hired me in that segment, and I was there 14 years in 13 different jobs.
Different besides just marketing?
Well, I mean, different disciplines. I ran promotions, entertainment marketing, ran worldwide advertising, led the team that created the Coca-Cola Polar Bears and the Always Coca-Cola campaign, ran Sprite when it shifted to NBA as a sponsored brand.
Right.
And so I had a phenomenal time, and I did it from 86 to 2000. In 2000, I went to Turner because I wanted to run a P&L.
Right.
When you're a marketing guy, you're the L in a P&L. And I wanted to, run a business, and Turner gave me a perfect creative and business outlook. And I was there from 2000 to 2014.
Again, trying to remember what life is like, because people think of creative and think of marketing now in completely new ways, right?
Absolutely.
Again, pre-internet, we had computers, as I recall. I'm trying to think of my early jobs. And you said you have this specific in around around the liquor brands. I'm kind of curious to hear a little bit more about that, what you thought you were going to, like, they were ignoring that part of the market? Like,
are you talking?
When you first came in there.
Into Coke?
Yes.
There were no programs to, for the bar and tavern segment to promote, you know, non-alcoholic beverages. And so Coke was thought of as a mixer rather than an alcohol alternative.
Right.
And so we created a series of non-alcoholic drinks and merchandise to take to the bar and tavern segment to right. offer those type of beverage alternatives, because there was so much pressure coming from to bars and don't drive drunk. You got to remember, to the mid-80s, there was no awareness for drinking and driving was a problem. It literally was kind of never spoken. And then some, unfortunately, some people who had grave losses in their family decided to create this campaign. And I saw it as an opportunity for Coke to do something both good for the public and good for their business.
And so then how did this Polar Bear business come along?
The 1992 Barcelona Olympics were an important platform for Coca-Cola. And Pepsi had been kicking Coke's butt in advertising. They had really taken the relevance and the pop culture piece of it. So
they had Michael Jackson and whatnot.
Michael Jackson, Michael J. Fox, and really had become
all the big 80s superstars.
Exactly. And Coke had built a global network with McCann Erickson out of New York, an IPG company. And it had good advertising, but it didn't have breakthrough advertising. And credit to Herbert Allen, Roberto Goizueta, and Don Keough. Don was president of Coke. Roberto was chairman, and Herbert Allen was a senior board member. And Herbert suggested that they talk with a guy named Michael Ovitz, who ran a company called CAA, because he represented basically the vortex of creative power at the time, whether it was Madonna, Tom Cruise, Rob Reiner. And so we hired CAA to be at our ad agency. And I was very fortunate when Coke owned Columbia Pictures, I got to do some work with Michael Ovitz, who ran CAA, on behalf of the company, and we built a really strong relationship. And one of Michael's conditions for becoming head of Coke Advertising was that I represent the company working with him. So one day I'm promotions director, and the next day I'm head of global advertising for the biggest brand in the world. And we delivered in a really big way. The Always Coca-Cola campaign was a huge smash, drove business, and created the iconic Polar Bears.
Well, you know, some might think a brand like Coca-Cola is such a global brand that how does one even begin to tackle continue? Like, can one company always grow? Can you really do better year on year?
And that's the objective of these companies. And yeah, you can. And you do it with new products, with new innovation, with better efficiencies and operational expertise. But, you know, soft drinks were kind of an idea, if you will, meaning you paid more per gallon for soft drinks than you did gasoline at the time. And so you were selling a little part of refreshment, but a whole lot of psychology. And so having a brand was a badge. You know, a lot of people, and we saw it when New Coke, you were a youngster back
then. I definitely remember New Coke.
But it kind of unlocked an emotional resonance for the brand with people. And either you're a Coke household or a Pepsi household.
Right.
And remember, the democracy of choice of in beverage and television, and there's a million podcasts probably, literally, allows for people to make choices. In the 80s and 90s, there weren't a lot of beverage choices. Snapple was coming up. You know, you didn't have this plethora of different brands. You had a few that dominated.
Right. There wasn't any of the water brands. There wasn't 20 sports drinks. There was one, right? There was Gatorade.
Yeah. I mean, again, the democratization of going into a store and there's 500 to choose from. You used to go in a store and there were 5 to choose from.
Right. But when you say you were a Coke or a Pepsi household, everyone here was a Coke household.
It's like one day my mom called me and said, I'm a little concerned. And I said, what are you concerned about? She goes, I'm not sure what you do every day. Doesn't everyone drink Coke?
Right.
And I said, Mom, that's the most Atlanta perspective you could ever have.
Right.
It's a big world out there. And there's a lot of people who don't drink Coke.
What's do you even know, like, what's the market share today? Like, are they still like 50-50-ish, or because they've you know, purchased so many brands?
No, I mean, I think in the soft drink market, Coke is dominating. It's over 60%.
It is over 60.
But you have to look at the total beverage market, and I think Coca-Cola is less than 2% of all liquids that are consumed today. And so the growth of that company in recent years has come from waters,
right,
and teas and juices and, you know, non-carbonated. But in the good old days when I was there, it was the fastest growing stock in the 80s and 90s, and it was all about carbonated beverages.
You seem to have this great path, right? Like all these different jobs, and they go really well, and then you end up at Turner, and you're there for a while, and then you're here. What do you think when I guess young folks ask you, like, well, hey, like, what are your keys to success, or how have you just continued to be someone that people, you know, you said Michael Ovitz tapped you. Clearly other people have, you know, sort of tapped you and said, well, we want you on our team.
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I'm a risk taker, but a measured risk taker. And what I mean by that is failing has never scared me. You know, it's always fueled me. And to me, the way to differentiate myself was through creativity and innovation, to think different of how to approach something. And there are a lot of people who have a lot better skills than I do in a lot of areas, but creativity and leadership and treating people well. You know, there's been books written, all the lessons you need to learn in life you learn in kindergarten.
Right.
And treating the people that I work with well and with respect and transparency and being able to communicate with people and have a vision to lead to has been very successful for me.
So you were at Turner for how long?
14 more years. I've had two 14-year jobs.
And again, getting, you know, again, the landscape has changed so much. So what year did you get to Turner?
I got to Turner in 2000 when cable was just getting ready to explode. Like 58 million households turned into over 100 million that had cable while I was there.
So would you believe, so I was living in Los Angeles for a while, and I worked for a lot of these promotional companies, and I was part of that campaign, that crazy one that they thought was some sort of hoax.
The Adult Swim?
Correct.
And who are you with?
Well, the agency out of New York hired me, and I forget the name of their...
Were you the one who put all the light brights under bridges and stuff?
No, those were the guys, those like the crazy hippie guys, those were the Boston guys.
Right.
That was the one that we just put it up on.
Oh, so you did it in L.A. with no problems.
Correct.
Ah.
And they were up for 2 weeks with no problems.
Should we tell people what we're talking about?
Yes. Why don't you explain?
It actually, we had three divisions, a news division, which was CNN.
Right.
An entertainment, which was TBS, TNT, True TV, Turner Classic Movies. That's what I ran. And then you're talking about the kids division, which was Cartoon Network and Adult Swim.
Right.
And Adult Swim, which was this genius of a network embedded in a network that was created by a guy named Mike Lazo, always looked for guerrilla alternative marketing ideas. And they had a show, which I can't remember the name of, but the marketing were these, think of the kid's toy Light Bright,
right,
of this little alien giving somebody the finger. And in a bunch of major metropolitan cities, agencies like yours would put them up in obvious and not so obvious places. And if you were a fan of that show,
you knew what they were.
They got put up in Boston. They got put under bridges and in a few places. And this was high, high, high sensitivity after 9/11. And the city officials in Boston literally shut down the city, thinking they were bombs.
Right.
And they weren't. And it was one of the oddest days I've ever had at work. I'm watching CNN reporting on all these bombs that were placed around Boston. And I was in meetings talking about how Cartoon Network had placed these light brights. And it was the, oh my God, it's us.
Right.
And Phil Kent, who was CEO at the time of Turner, immediately flew up to Boston, where the mayor read him the riot act, and the governor was going, they were going to arrest Phil.
Right.
I mean, it was unbelievable.
Well, it was sadly one of those, you know, what I would call an overreaction. And it wouldn't, today I don't think it would happen, because people would have so many pictures on their phone of this is clearly just a toy, essentially. But the biggest problem I had with it was that they kept using the word hoax, even when they realized a hoax means you're trying to trick someone.
Correct.
And the media kept using that word, even though everyone knew it wasn't. It was just, anyway, I was disappointed all the way around. But yes, they were up in Los Angeles for 2 weeks. The agency called me immediately and said, could you drive around and take those down and get them back to our warehouse, which I did. I later found they were going on eBay for like $1,000.
Yes.
I was a good steward and I returned them. Had I known, maybe I would have kept one, because I certainly could have used $1,000 back then.
Right.
But yeah, they were up in 10 cities with no issues.
Exactly.
And Boston freaked out.
I think in a lot of ways that changed promotion, because we talked about intelligent risk taking.
Right.
A lot of people would say, where you put these things, I'll bet your agency didn't put them under bridges and bypasses in some of the...
They're mostly on stores, I think.
Right, exactly. I think most of the agencies had put them in a more retail-friendly, consumer-friendly. And, you know, if you're running a city and you see these alien things giving you the finger, you might overreact. It was not a fun day at Turner. In hindsight, it's pretty funny. But at the time, seeing the stress that was in that building was just unbelievable.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So, again, I feel like everything has changed so much in a relatively short time. Even, you know, when you were at Turner, what was your last title there?
I was president of the entertainment division.
Okay, as opposed to, it seems like their entertainment company, right?
No, meaning that there was a news division, a kids division, and entertainment. So I ran the big brands, TBS and TNT.
Right. And was there another calling you thought was out there for you?
Well, what was interesting was I've been very fortunate in my career that I've literally caught two growth waves.
Right.
You know, soft drinks in the 80s and 90s and cable television. And by 2014, you can see disruption was coming with Netflix.
Right.
You could see that the world and the way... We talked about democratization of the grocery store with beverages. All of a sudden, you can watch what you want to watch, when you want to watch, with no commercials. And cable couldn't get its act together. The idea was there. It was called TV Everywhere, where everybody would make, if you have a cable subscription, you can watch anything, and you can watch all the reruns and, you know, and binge. But the cable operator and the programmer, we couldn't get along enough. Well enough to reward the consumer, and instead we punished the consumer, meaning you could only get 5 episodes.
Right.
You know, and if you missed the first 5 and the 5 through 10 was up, sorry, you'll have to wait till the DVD comes out and then buy them. So everything that an industry can do to be non-consumer friendly compared to Netflix, which, you know, Netflix started its streaming business as a movie business, and they couldn't get enough volume. So they started by what was called broken series. And broken series were like 24, highly serialized, that did not work in a rerun environment on FX or USA or TNT. And all of a sudden, people were really enjoying watching this binging experience. And the programmers, like my group, we would sell to Netflix and just be delighted to bring in all this money. I mean, our business was going through the roof. All the companies were. And it's like we sold guns to the bad guys. And when they pointed them at us, we go, hey, what's wrong with you? And literally, Netflix was built on the back. I mean, Friends and Seinfeld. And last week, there were $2 billion for Friends, Seinfeld, Big Bang Theory, and The Office reruns to be sold to streaming.
Wow.
And we had all of those on TBS.
Right.
But we had them with commercials, and we played them when... We wanted you to see him,
right?
Rather than when you wanted to see him.
Does Jerry get paid again, by the way?
Oh, yes, he does.
God.
Yeah.
Dog.
Yeah. Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld.
Oof.
Do not cry for them.
Let's talk about Conan, speaking of things in TBS.
So early 2010, Conan and NBC had a very public divorce. At the time, we were looking for new day parts that we can grow our business. So we got into the late night business with George Lopez. And George had a good show that was doing well with a new audience of young Hispanic audience that weren't coming to TBS. And we just kind of were following the Conan trail, and it looked like he was going to Fox. And then one day I read an article that said that he and Fox couldn't get aligned. So I made a couple of phone calls, flew out 3 days later to see him, pitched him in the room, a vision that he would come to TBS and he would become the face of the network, that he would have a show at 11 o'clock four nights a week, and he could have Friday to either have it off or create more material. And he, in 9 very quiet, secret days, we got a deal done that rocked the TV industry.
Right.
And he still remains a really close friend today. I talk to him all the time.
That's great.
And he's been on TBS now, going on, starting his 10th year.
Where does the time go, Steve?
I don't know, but yeah, that was a real highlight because he was and is so culturally relevant, such a talented guy.
It's a pretty big coup.
And it was a big coup for cable at the time.
Right.
You know, it was a big coup to take somebody who, again, back to the consumer, they were outraged that he was fired, that he lost his job, that he didn't do anything wrong, but Jay Leno came back and grabbed his job, and he was and still is a bit of a folk hero for sticking it to the man. He didn't accept, you know, just push it later.
Right.
He said, this isn't right. And he stood up for what was right. And then by good fortune, we connected really, really well. And here we are today in 2019. He's still on the air.
Right.
And he's still culturally relevant as he was over in Greenland trying to broker the sale of Greenland to the United States recently.
Interesting. So, again, I feel like even in 10 years, so much has changed. And, you know, once upon a time, if you weren't on the big three, you kind of weren't anywhere, right? And now with streaming, I feel like even just being on Facebook Live, you can get more eyeballs than you can get on, say, USA Network.
It's wildly different. Last night was the Emmys.
Right.
They were broadcast on Fox. Not one broadcast show won an award. It literally was a 3-hour show for Amazon. Fleabag won Best Comedy.
Right.
I don't think most of us had ever even heard of Fleabag if you weren't kind of industry-centric.
Right.
You saw Mrs. Maisel win. You saw Game of Thrones HBO.
Bill Hader won.
Bill Hader won for Barry.
That's a great show.
Great show.
Well, probably one of the best shows on television.
Absolutely. But what used to be the purview of broadcast, you know, and that's why the Emmys are broadcast on broadcast. We took a run for it, offered a ton of money to move them to TBS and TNT.
Right.
But the Academy felt that they would alienate the broadcasters, and here we are 6-7 years later from when we made that offer, and there's not even broadcasters nominated. I think This Is Us is the only nominated show from broadcast last night. So it has changed so fast and so radically that nobody saw it coming like this. And now you have Disney owns Fox and AT&T owns Turner and Warner Brothers. It's, you know, I'm pretty happy to be in another industry that I think is on the right side of the wave, and that's sports and live events.
All right, so there's a perfect segue to say...
I was trying to give you one.
He's a pro. That you said you were on two waves. I would say the NBA is having a bit of a moment.
A bit of a moment, yes.
Would you not say that you've...
I agree.
You've come upon another...
I definitely think I've come upon something that's very, very special. And again, I think they're all interconnected. I think that television used to be the electronic hearth in a home. You would watch shows with your family together. And now I think consuming video, let's call it, is an isolated incident. Whether you're watching YouTube on your phone or your kids are in their rooms on their iPads. And so I think what people are looking for is shared experiences. And we've seen sports attendance go up, music live events go up, festival attendance go up. So I think people are looking for things to do together,
right,
but to experience together so they can create video and share it with their communities.
Right. So my son knows who Steph Curry is and knows who Odell Beckham is, not because he's watched game after game, but because he's watched YouTube videos, because he's watched, you know, Fortnite. And he's, so my son's 10, by the way.
Right.
And it's a very different experience that he's played Madden, and so he knows these moves of these players before actually watching. I don't think he's ever watched a football game for 3 straight hours.
Yeah, I mean, we know 99% of our fans globally will never walk in an NBA arena. And so you reach them through video games, NBA 2K, YouTube videos, Instagram, House of Highlights. And again, it's that continued fracturing of the established media piece that if you wanted to watch a game, we'll show you one a week. To today, you can literally almost follow a game on Twitter.
Right.
And so it's... I think it helps the brand, and I think it makes media more and more valuable when you have something that really resonates with consumers.
Well, it's interesting you talk about people going to things more and more. You know, Carl and I spoke about, or maybe actually, it might have been somebody else, spoke about how, you know, we've got this gigantic facility, not yours, the one across the street.
Mercedes-Benz.
And that people were enjoying the accoutrement so much that they weren't in the seats. So how do we find that? How do we find that balance?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have the same problem. We have 6 clubs in our new building. We were just voted number one in game day by the fans, the top building by the fans. And you can't legislate how people consume your product. We built these multi-viewing decks. We have all these center court bars. And I want to thank everybody for coming in, but I'm not going to say, sit in your seat. And if you decide, we built a bar on the floor. So our floor seat holders have the Hawk Bar, which is a continuation of the floor right behind the basket. And a lot of our front row people are having a drink standing at the Hawk Bar rather than sitting in their seat. And it bothers some folks, but candidly, you can't tell people how to have fun and how to use these nights to socialize. It's very, very different.
So I was just there. I went to watch wrestling with my son.
With your 10-year-old, I hope.
Yeah, yes, with my 10-year-old. Well, there are plenty of adult men that go without their 10-year-olds.
I love wrestling.
Do you watch wrestling?
I do not, but it is a huge passion of my son, who is 31-year-old.
Okay.
Sports agent at, ironically, CAA.
Okay.
Who does a lot of work with WWE and actually had flown in, gone to meetings with the WWE at the building and flew back to New York that night where he lives.
Nice.
So I'm very aware of wrestling.
So, I made friends with a referee a couple of years ago, and I've been able to go pretty much every time they're in town. And, you know, we went down to a show in Macon, and my son got to meet John Cena, my then 8-year-old son. And I said, listen, you know, at this point, you can have whatever you want. Like, you made me my hero to my son.
Right.
Like, he can tell his friends he met John Cena. So,
exactly.
Like, whatever you need. So, let me ask you a silly beverage question. So, once upon a time, when you would go to the arena, right, and you would order a water, right, they would take the top from you because they did not want you throwing the top, apparently, on the floor. But they would give you the bottle, which you could throw on the floor. Now, you get nothing. They pour it in a giant cup for you.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure you quite got that right. The top was taken off, so if you threw a bottle, the water would disperse before it hit the intended target.
Aha.
So, no, we're not worried about people throwing tops. It was throwing bottles.
Okay.
Second of all, I don't know, we poured it in cups that night at the arena.
Yes.
Then that was a WWE thing.
Aha. So it's...
Because policy is not to do that.
What is the policy if I go to a Hawks game?
That will give you a bottle sounds the top.
Right.
You will not have the top.
Okay. And was this a league thing? Was this an NBA thing?
Yeah. And it's a smart thing because bad referee call, somebody sails a bottle from the upper deck. By the time it lands, it's an empty, you know, third of an ounce plastic bottle.
Got it.
Not a 2-pound object.
Okay.
Water's heavy.
Okay. Could you...
Really?
We corrected the camera.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't know the top of it.
This is what we're devolving to?
Listen, I mean, I could ask you a lot of the same standard questions people have asked you for 100 years, but how fun would that be?
None. I'm loving it.
All right.
Could you?
Well, now that we're in that territory.
Could you?
Yes.
No, you were asking. Could you?
Could you? Because across the street, I'm going to call it across the street, has done a specific thing about, hey, we're not going to kill you on the prices.
We've already done it.
Could you knock the prices down?
We've already done it. We matched them.
You did?
Yeah.
The WWE did not match.
Yes, they did.
Are you kidding me? I paid, what did I pay for, like, I don't know, I think I paid a pretty penny.
No, you didn't.
Okay, what should I pay for a burger?
$4.
I paid 10.
Well, you might have gotten a gourmet steak burger.
No, it was tiny, dude. It was a piece of, I'm telling you.
No, so not
the,
right.
So the WWE screwed me is what you're saying?
No, they didn't. What I'm saying is, it depends. If you went to the New York Prime.
I did not go to New York Prime.
It is $4 for a burger.
Told you what section I was in, would that help?
Sure.
So 112, when you come out, there's a nice big bar.
Yeah.
Just beyond that was the burgers and fries and shakes.
That is the premium burger, fries, and shakes.
Premium?
Premium. We have $4 burgers, hand fresh patty, fresh cut.
So I should have walked just down the hall and I would have got a $4 burger.
Correct.
All right, my mistake then. This is good to know next time I go to wrestling or a Hawks game.
And the beverages were $2. You can get 2 slices of pizza and a water for $10.
When did you match them? When did that happen?
2 years ago.
Okay. So you guys just talked and were like, hey, we're doing this super nice thing.
Well, we saw it worked. I mean, customer satisfaction matters. You know, so we saw that when the Falcons did it, there was a tremendous approval from Atlanta, and candidly, I went to the national championship game, ran upstairs to get 4 waters, pulled a $50 bill out of my pocket, handed it to the lady, and she gave me $42 back. And it dawned on me, wow, that's great. This is what I would have paid at a convenience store.
Right.
And it was such a positive experience that as soon as we redid the building, we opened with that fan-friendly menu on the top 13 items. So I'm sorry that you went to the premium one that was most convenient, not to the most valuable one.
Now I will, everyone listening and watching, please, if you go to the place and you see the menu, it says 10, just walk around the corner.
Well, like we have pizza for $4 a slice.
Right.
And we have Antico pizza. One is premium to the other.
Right.
And that was a Pat LaFrieda burger out of New York.
Okay. Good to know. When the season starts, which is shortly here, a month or so away.
Yep.
Does the amount of sleep you get, like, do you live and die in every game on every point?
No. And that's been a real adjustment. My first year here, we won 60 games. And I'm like, this is fantastic. Work all day, go to a game, have a ball.
For those listening that aren't aware, that's what, 70%?
Yeah, I mean,
a good winning percentage.
We were number one. We're number one in the Eastern Conference. Went to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time and ran into a gentleman named LeBron James.
Tough to beat that
guy. It kind of ended there, but it has for a lot of teams as he made the finals 8 years in a row. I've learned to modulate. I've learned to, instantly celebrate the wins and instantly mourn the losses. It's part of sports. But the most important thing that I focus on are we getting better both on the business side and the basketball side? And continuous improvement will get us to where we want to be.
How does one in your position even decide to divvy up your time, right? Because there's two things, right? There's this business and then there's this team.
Well, I mean, the season's long. It's very long. You work all day and you go to the game at night. But once the game starts, if everything goes according to plan, then it's just hospitality for me because I have such great people that I work with. They do their job. So building maintenance, concessions, security, ticketing, game operations, media, internet, all of those things hopefully go off without a hitch. And every night when a game's over, we have an incident report. We do thousands of consumer surveys the next day, and then we have an after action group that looks at those surveys and see where we fell down and what we need to improve or what we did well and what we need to make sure that we thank people for and reinforce the positives. So every game, every event that's in that building, we're constantly looking at the data to help us improve.
So again, back to that earlier question, once upon a time, you know, butts and seats is what mattered. When you said, you know, it's fine if they're doing whatever, if they're experiencing State Farm, but if they're consuming, you know, through Twitter or through however, that's not as important to you?
Well, no, I want to be clear. I want them to come to the building. What they do once they're there,
right,
is where I think we've democratized how you consume the game in the building. We want to build fans. We want them to consume through television, through radio, through our Instagram and social media.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we want to build home court advantage. That is the number one objective, is to build the best home court advantage, and that's people in the building. And again, if you're standing on your feet screaming or you're sitting in your seat screaming, we just want you in the building.
Did you grow up a Hawks fan?
Huge Hawks fan. Huge. I actually had better season tickets when I took the job than I have currently. You know, I was fortunate. I sat on the front row on the court and would go to as many games as my schedule would allow.
And then what about the other teams?
I had Braves season tickets for 37 years and Falcons. I was at their last game against Philadelphia. So, yes, I'm a huge Atlanta sports fan, which led me to come to do this, because as much as television had changed, it still would have been a hell of a fun ride. And my team that I built at Turner, you know, has done a very good job of keeping the business competitive. But I wanted to do something that was a little bit more community. So I believe that sports can connect a community better than any policy or politician. I think we can change and influence a city in the most positive direction. And we're doing that. We build bridges through basketball. We've built 26 basketball courts in underserved communities. We've provided eyeglasses and vision screenings for tens of thousands of kids. And we're very, very, very active in trying to be a leading citizen in the community. And I think we've succeeded in that, creating jobs and creating new opportunities.
What do you think about the stadium up the road, the old SunTrust Park?
I think they've done a brilliant job, and I think the idea of combining retail and sports makes a lot of sense. As, you know, malls and anchor stores, it used to be you'd go to the mall for the anchor big store, and today with shopping online, sports arenas and stadiums are where you're getting 30, 40,000 people to come a night, and to build facilities around that to give people things to do, I think it's a fabulous piece of business. And that's why the Gulch, which is right over your shoulder, is our next big project, as we're trying to revitalize downtown Atlanta.
And what's going in the Gulch?
Well, it's going to be a $5 billion project, 12.5 million square feet of live, work, and play. And hopefully we're going to build a little LA Live type city
right
across from the two sports arenas.
So are you thinking not as tall, just like more wide, or?
Both. 12.5 million square feet, several high-rise office buildings, apartments, and entertainment complexes, all strategically placed to leverage both MARTA and the fans that come to the game.
Well, you know, a lot of folks I talk to are really bummed out about the Braves. They took it very personally that the Braves went north.
My first day with my wife was to a Braves game. And
at the old Fulton County Stadium.
I have the seats that they were nice enough to give me when they tore down the stadium. They pulled our two seats.
That was very sweet of them.
Very sweet of them. They're in the basement of my house collecting a little bit of dust. I'm not sure what I need with 36-year-old baseball seats, but it's a great icon and a memory. You know, it's progress. I wish they were still in downtown Atlanta. I wish that there was a cluster of Braves, Hawks, and Falcon stadiums right near each other with a big retail development to support them.
Right.
But I have to admire what they've done, because what they've done has been really, really special.
Well, you know, when the Super Bowl was here and I spoke to the media folks, they were thrilled that we have everything right here. They said this is so much better than where we were the year before, and I think that's good for us. I think that means we'll get another one here in a couple of years.
Well, I think the concentration of hotels and facilities is a real big positive for us. And, you know, as a native Atlanta, and I'm sure you feel the same way, when you read people loved that Atlanta's a walking city, you went, walking city. People drive to their mailbox.
Right, but, exactly.
But if you think about it, the park was a central location. We had the Super Bowl concert series, the game at Mercedes-Benz, all the hotels in this area. It really was quite walkable. My son, who was in on business, stayed at the Hyatt and walked to everything, you know, because traffic was limited and the city shined. Did a really, really, really good job that weekend.
Yeah, I thought so too. So I always, my last few questions are always Atlanta-based. They're about your favorite things at Atlanta. Are you ready?
Yeah.
What is your go-to order at the Waffle House?
A fiesta omelet, no jalapenos, hash browns, well done.
What is in a fiesta omelet?
Ham, cheese, onions, and tomato.
But they usually put jalapenos in there, but you leave those out.
I leave those out.
Not a fan of the hot stuff.
Not a fan of the hot stuff.
What is your favorite current restaurant in Atlanta?
Oh, there's so many great ones. I love Kima. I'm a big fish guy. Kima has great grilled fish. Antico Posta on Far Road, on East Paces Ferry has great grilled fish. And there's so many new ones in East Atlanta that we're constantly exploring. It's like living in another city when we go around this town. It is just, used to be Perimeter, Buckhead, Marietta.
Right.
And now it's exploded. And I think it's a world of great places to go eat.
Finish the sentence. I take Marta blank.
To work.
Really?
Yeah.
That is a very rare answer.
Well, there's a Marta station 15 feet from work.
Right.
And it's really easy on a weekend when there's lots of traffic and things going on downtown just to go park and hop on Marta and come to work.
Well, most folks, their answer is either rarely to the airport or to games. Well, most folks do not commute to work. That's great.
Yes.
Do you feel it's part of your civic duty?
No. I feel like it's easy, fast, safe, and it just kind of works for us. Tony Ressler, who is the owner of our team, when he was looking for a place to live, wanted to be next to a MARTA station so he could take MARTA downtown to the games because he doesn't want to spend a lot of time in traffic.
How many owners are there?
There are 15 owners, but Tony's the principal owner.
Got it. All right, now, believe it or not, the next question I ask everybody.
Okay.
But I have to ask you.
Yep.
Rank these in importance to you.
Okay.
Braves, Falcons, Hawks, United.
Hawks, number one. Hawks, number two. Georgia Bulldogs, number three.
Wow, really going off the board.
And Hawks, number four.
Okay. What do you think the most common answer is these days?
Well, I would say Braves.
You would be incorrect.
Falcons.
You're really incorrect.
Hawks.
People love the soccer team.
Oh, yes, I know. Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of probably the best stories in sports the last 20 years of how a city, which has never been known as a great sports town,
right,
has just captured a diverse young audience with rituals that rival the SEC and made going to a soccer game, or a game with, I'll say, little action, low results,
right,
2-1.
1-0.
Dynamically exciting. And I think Darren Eales, who heads that operation up, has done a spectacular, spectacular job.
You have no envy whatsoever?
I have huge envy.
Okay.
I seethe with anger. But I'm just filled with admiration for what he's done.
What do you think we can learn from those guys?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that we can learn, and that is grassroots marketing and connecting to people and letting fans have a voice.